Hi there, I'm Dr. Trevor Cates. Welcome to the Spa Doctor Podcast. Today we're talking about something we haven't covered before on the Spa Doctor Podcast, and that's the health and skin problems associated with mold exposure. Mold exposure can lead to a number of symptoms. Some of the early warning signs can show up on the skin, and these can include acne, hives, dermatitis, and other rashes. And there can be other symptoms like fatigue, weight gain, brain fog, memory loss, and unexplained pain, and a number of other symptoms. If you have any of these skin or other symptoms and you haven't been able to get to the root cause, your answer may be in this podcast. My guest today is Dr. Jill Carnahan. Dr. Jill received her medical degree from Loyola University Stritch School of Medicine. She is double board certified in family medicine and integrative holistic medicine. Dr. Jill was part of the first group of healthcare practitioners to be certified in functional medicine through the Institute of Functional Medicine. She founded Flatiron Functional Medicine in Boulder, Colorado, where she partnered in functional medicine with Dr. Robert Roundtree. She recently opened a new medical clinic in Louisville, Colorado. Dr. Jill is a 15-year survivor of breast cancer and Crohn's disease and is passionate about teaching patients how to live well and thrive in the midst of complex and chronic illness. She's committed to teaching other physicians how to address underlying causes of illness rather than treating symptoms. So she helps both patients and other physicians. On today's podcast, we cover how to know if mold exposure may be an issue for you and what you can do about it. Dr. Jill covers specifics like testing and valuable resources that I think you'll be really interested to hear about. Whether or not you think mold is an issue for you and your health, I think this is going to be really interesting for you. Many of the symptoms of mold exposure can be misdiagnosed with other health conditions. So it's important to know what to look for because it may be the missing piece for your health. So please enjoy this interview. Dr. Jill, it's great to have you on my podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so let's start off with you and how you got interested in functional medicine.
Absolutely. So I had always wanted to go into a healing profession, and I didn't know if it was going to be physical therapy or chiropractic. And my heart and mind has always been much more natural, alternative medicine. So I wanted to get to root cause. I wanted to do nutrition and teach patients to live well. And what ended up happening is I did an undergraduate degree that would, you know, allow me to do any kind of health profession, and then looked at the different schools. And what I realized was I probably had the best chance of changing allopathic model by going into it and actually coming from the inside out and making some changes. So I feel like it was a great way to go to get a medical degree, because obviously the system is really set up for that. But my heart has always been much more root cause oriented than that. So I ended up going to medical school at Loyola. And then during my medical school training in my third year, a lot of people have heard my story, but I was diagnosed at 25 with breast cancer. And for your listeners who don't know, it's a disease in young women. So it's a whole different ballgame than for the 55-year-old woman who gets a tumor that's very slow growing. So I took a leave of absence from medical school and took everything I had, my, you know, social network and prayer and meditation and all of that stuff. And then I had surgery, I had radiation, I had three drug chemotherapy, lost all my hair, was very, very, very sick from that, but I recovered and I beat the breast cancer. And that was definitely a catalyst, because it was during that time I learned the term functional medicine, and I had always wanted to do that. I just didn't know what it was called. So it was pretty exciting to learn there was a name and a group that was of course led by Jeff Bland in the old days. And so I really started attaching myself to that and learning everything I could about nutrition and wellness and functional medicine. And I really feel that, you know, the chemotherapy, the drugs, all of that helped me recover at that time because it was so aggressive. But for the last 16 years, the health that I have today is because of functional medicine and the recovery from all of that toxic therapy that was essential, but still very, very toxic.
Yeah. So you used it for treating the breast cancer, you used a conventional medical approach, but then recovering from that, you learned about functional medicine and how to support the body to kind of get your body back to a healthy state, right?
Exactly. Because that stuff is so toxic and it's absolutely necessary for survival. I never have regretted the fact that I did it, but I was very, very traumatized and sick from the therapy itself, from multiple surgeries, radiation, chemotherapy, lost all my hair. So it was a definite recovery. And I'm totally grateful to functional medicine for that in the interim.
And like you said, and breast cancer, getting breast cancer in your 40s, I mean, in your 20s is different than in like your 40s or 50s or later. It's much more aggressive, right? And
yeah.
So doing having the approach that you took is probably the one that you needed to do. And it sounds like you're healthy now. And you
yeah.
look like, you know, maybe it was just 5 years ago, but I think you're probably
oh.
older than 30.
yeah.
Okay. So, you know, something in particular I wanted us to cover today is the chronic inflammatory response syndrome. And so tell us about how you got interested in that. And I want to talk a lot about mold-related symptoms today and mold-related illness.
Absolutely. So this is an area that until I had a personal encounter with a mold-related illness, even as a functional medicine practitioner for the last 15 years, I did not realize the amount of patients who have this and the amount of things that can masquerade as what we call CIRS. It's called chronic inflammatory response syndrome. And the basics are this. So there's about 24% of the population who has the genetics. It's HLA types. And HLAs are basically our little Pac-Man in the immune system that sample the things that come into our gut or our environment or on our skin or in our lungs. And those genetics tell our body what's foreign, what's bad and dangerous, and what's not. And for the people, the 24% of the, we call the canaries, that are very susceptible to mold-related illness, they have trouble distinguishing this bad toxin from something that's normal. So their body isn't able to tag it well, and therefore they accumulate these toxins in their body, and it sets off their immune system. It's like starting, you throw the gasoline on the campfire, and then you throw a match in it, and it explodes with the flames, and that's what happens in their immune system. It's almost like that trigger, that toxin, we call them biotoxins, and they can be from fish or from lime or from mold, which is probably the most common. That triggers their immune system to kind of go crazy, and that immune system response is actually what makes them sick, not the toxin itself. So the toxin is the match that lights the fire in the immune system, and then the immune system releases cytokines and does collateral damage to tissues and affects the endocrine system. And we can go into the details, but it's amazing how far-reaching and how many systems. I would venture to say that nearly every system in the body is affected by mold in someone who's genetically susceptible. But the foundation is that genetic susceptibility, because the other 76% of the population can get exposed to mold. They might sneeze or have a little congestion, but they're not going to get this immune illness as the other people.
And that's a really interesting thing, because I know that, you know, you think of mold and you're like, okay, well, it naturally grows. It's not something made by man necessarily. It can be, but it does mm-hmm. grow in a right environment. And it's natural. So why is it that something that nature creates, how could that be so toxic? And so what you're talking about is that it's not necessarily toxic for everyone, but for those people that have that genetic predisposition. How people know if they have that genetic issue?
Yeah, so this is a simple blood test that can be done through LabCorp, and it's called HLA-DR typing. And Dr. Shoemaker, who was the original researcher on CIRS, has the Rosetta Stone on his website, survivingmold.com. And so you can go there and see if your genes link up. This test is also now available to the public without a doctor's order through life extension. So that's a really neat thing now, because it was, if you go through insurance, it could be a couple thousand dollars. And of course, the insurance will discount it. But nowadays, a patient can order directly through life extension, HLA mold typing, get their results themselves. And I think it's only a couple hundred dollars.
Okay, great. That's a great tool. And I think when people hear the word mold, they think, okay, this is for people who live in on the coast, that live in a beach town where there's a lot of moisture in the air and a very humid environment like New Orleans or something. But we know mold grows across the country, right? It grows around the world, really. So is this an issue that, do you feel like it's a location-based thing?
No, I think there can be mold almost anywhere. And there's a lot of people who are looking for a safe house or a safe place. And there's certainly areas that are more dry and more likely to be safe. And especially outdoors, when you go inside the walls of a building, especially now with all the environmental controls where there's less airflow from inside to outside, it tends to be a much more toxic environment. So a lot of people could live in a tent on a, in a campground and might be okay, whereas in a house they wouldn't. But back to environment. So what we see is certainly you would think like Arizona, New Mexico, our states of Utah and Colorado would all be good. But there's still flooding. We had a flood in Boulder about 2, 3 years ago in 2013. And that really devastated so many of the buildings because they got water intrusion. And that's the core is water intrusion. And obviously, even in dry climates, you can have water intrusion, a leak from the roof, or you can have condensation. In some of the real hot climates, you'll have condensation because of the heat change from the air conditioning inside to outside. And that condensation alone can cause mold issues. Certainly areas like Hawaii, Miami, Florida, there's definitely more humid areas that have a lot more issues with mold. But what happens is really any building that's airtight and has a mold issue can be a problem no matter what the climate.
And so many of our homes are airtight because of the newer construction. And wintertime, we want our homes to stay warm and be energy efficient. And so they're really well sealed. And but the problem is that this is getting trapped in our homes. So, what are the kinds of things to look for? What are some of the common symptoms?
Yeah, so there's a cluster analysis which we look at sets of symptoms that have been studied. And if you have 8 or more of the clusters, there's 13 of them, you're considered positive for CIRS. And I'll just name a few because if people hear them, they might recognize some symptoms or especially the unique ones that they might have. Fatigue is probably number one. And obviously, that can masquerade. I mean, it could be chronic fatigue, it could be fibromyalgia, there could be a lot of other diseases besides mold. But there are a subset of genetic canaries that have a gene 4353, and that one is very susceptible to fatigue-related illness and depression. So fatigue is number one. Memory, word finding, memory issues are really, really common. Weakness, achiness in the joints, like morning stiffness, headaches are common. Difficulty with new knowledge assimilation, so they might be reading something over and over again and they can't comprehend it, whereas just a year before they were able to read very quickly. Concentration problems, which go right along with that. We mentioned morning stiffness and joint pain, which are real common. Unusual skin sensations, so numbness and tingling of the hands or feet can be common. Shortness of breath, sinus congestion, nasal drainage, cough, increased thirst, and increased urination. This is because the hormone, antidiuretic hormone, or vasopressin, is affected in the pituitary. And so these patients often have no regulation of hydration. So they drink and they pee and they drink and they pee and their body doesn't signal them to hold on to the water to keep their volume up. And they'll be low blood pressure, they'll have fainting or dizziness, and they'll often drink and drink and pee and pee and they can't stay hydrated. Appetite swings are real common. One very unique thing is patients in a moldy environment often will develop leptin resistance. And because of that, they can gain 30, 50 pounds in a very short period of time with no change in diet or exercise. And you can imagine how terrifying that is to a patient to suddenly have this massive amount of weight gain. It's less frequent to have weight loss, but that can also occur. And then the typical red eyes, blurry vision, changes in vision, difficult night vision, night sweats are very common. One really unusual thing is what we call ice pick pain. And that would be where they just describe it as a very sharp, like a knife going through their head. And this is very common with mold and not too common with other illnesses. Abdominal pain. So low MSH, which is part of this illness, affects the permeability of the gut. And I'm sure you've had guests talk about intestinal permeability and gluten sensitivity and all of that. And because mold is such a toxin to the tight junctions in the gut, we often have very much increased permeability. All of a sudden, they'll develop new food sensitivities. And even patients who don't have celiac disease will suddenly have a very adverse reaction to gluten. So it really affects the gut and the permeability. And then vertigo, I mentioned spinning sensation, lightheadedness, dizziness. And then another one that's very unique is electric or static shocks. So, you know, when you're padding around in your socks in the winter and you touch a light switch and you have a shock, well, these people all year round, summer and winter, they will have static shocks. And because of that, they'll often break watches or break electronics. They literally, because of that low ADH, so they have volume depletion in the body and they're sweating out salt on the surface of their skin. And because of that, they will often literally create a battery on the surface of their skin. And things like computers that they touch or watches that they wear, they will break. So that's really interesting.
Wow. There are some interesting symptoms that you mentioned in there that are probably disregarded by conventional medical doctors as just, that's just in your head or something like that. And then there are other things that have probably been diagnosed as something else, like chronic fatigue syndrome or menopause. If you talk about night sweats or maybe even Alzheimer's or dementia because of memory loss and difficulty focusing, diabetes because of the thirst and not being hydrated or the weight gain. When it comes to skin symptoms, are there any specific things that people should be looking for?
Oh, so glad you asked, because adult acne, I mean, how many people have it and are so frustrated? C4A, which is a big driver of the immune system and mold exposure, will cause cystic acne. And nothing will help, and it's not related to hormones. So taking care of that mold exposure will help. Hives, which is a histamine reaction, mold causes mast cells to be very reactive and produce excess histamine. And this hive reaction and typical like dermatographia, where you get a line if you pull a pencil across the skin, those are real common too, and that's all histamine related. And then things like dermatitis on the scalp or irritation, under any warm areas of the body, like in the folds of the skin and things, rashes are common. So the skin is a major organ where this.
And do you find that this is one of the first places it shows up, or is this later down the road?
Well, if we include like red eyes, irritated eyes, itching, scalp irritations, rashes, hives, acne, yes, yes. I would say this is commonly right off the bat.
Do you see a lot of people in your practice and have been given other diagnoses and not gotten any improvement from the treatment, and that's how they come in and they find out?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is probably the most common scenario that I see. So a couple of things. SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, super common. It's another name for IBS in many cases, so the typical gas and bloating and diarrhea. Very frequently, these patients have mold exposure or toxin exposure on top of that. Things like dementia. So Dr. Dale Bredesen presented some research, and brilliant researcher who does all Alzheimer's research. And his research was on young patients like 50s and 60s who develop dementia. And what he did was he applied the Sears protocol, the Shoemaker protocol, to the Sears-related illness in these patients who qualified. And over 30%, 1 in 3, had reversal of their dementia. This is just absolutely profound, because he realized there was a connection in his dementia patient, especially the early onset. So these younger people, you know, a 55-year-old female lawyer who all of a sudden, boom, she can't read the cases, she can't keep up, she's having memory difficulties, she's losing her keys. And he would identify those subset that had Sears, treat them, and that dementia reversed. And this is just so profound. It's been taking the functional medicine world by storm, because to reverse Alzheimer's dementia is pretty cool. and to see, yeah. So that, and then you mentioned chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, super common. So that pain syndromes, the fatigue syndromes, very commonly is a biotoxin-related illness. What's exciting is the typical chronic fatigue may be incurable, although with functional medicine, if we find the root cause, we can treat it. But with CIRS, it's treatable. So if patients find that this is the underlying root cause, it's very treatable and they can recover completely.
Yeah, that's amazing. And what you mentioned about Alzheimer's and dementia, I think about the elderly population and how a lot of people are in nursing homes or retirement or assisted living facilities. And if there's a mold issue in those facilities, then that could be a big part of what's going on with people that are staying there. So let's talk about how people can find out if there's mold in their homes or where they live.
Yes. So this is the conundrum I face every single day in clinical practice, because often I'll look at the lab work that I've drawn and I'll see a pattern that makes me think this patient may be exposed to mold. So then I'll have the conversation with them and say, hey, do you think there's any water damage? Have you had a roof that's leaked? Have you had a window that condenses? Any floods in the basement? Do you have a crawl space? Do you have a walkout basement? There's certain flat roof buildings like schools or offices that are flat roof. There's definitely certain patterns and things in building that you can ask about. But the majority of patients, even if they have had a mold exposure, they are like, nope, there's no mold, no issues, I'm fine. And they may or may not notice a musty smell. A musty smell itself, if any of your listeners right now have an area where there's a musty smell, that is VOCs, volatile organic solvents from mold. And it's likely there's an issue if you smell musty. So if you go in the hotel room or you travel or you're in an airport and you smell musty smells, you're probably smelling mold. But the bottom line, which your question alluded to, was how do you test? So the first thing is just visual. And obviously a patient themselves can look around and look for black spots on the ceiling. I know now when I go to a hotel room, the first thing I look for is the bathroom. I look up at the ceiling, I look in the corners, just make sure there's no massive amounts of mold. And you'd be surprised, some of those hotels with the pools in the middle and the big atriums, if you look up at the ducts and stuff at the top, they are black with mold. So I'm just cautious about that now that I'm aware. So patients themselves can look, and they can get an inspector to come take a look. And inspectors have things like infrared cameras. They can find moisture through walls. They can drill through the wall and actually take samples. They can, of course, do air sampling. But the most common thing that I recommend for my patients to do themselves without an inspector is something called an ERMI test. It's called ERMI, ERMI, and they can get that from mycometrics.com. And this is a dust sampling they can do of their home, and it's sent to the lab for DNA analysis of the types of molds that are in the dust in their home. Now, no test is perfect, so even that can miss things. Or in someone who had really, really a lot of dust, but no active mold issue, it could become false positive as well. But that's a great starting place, because the patient themselves can order the test, do it themselves, send it in, and get results and bring it in to me. And Dr. Shoemaker has done research on these top five molds called HERTSMI, HERTSMI2, and they're based on research. And those five molds, if you take and do the scoring, you can come up with a score from the ERMI test. I know these are a lot of names, but you basically get the ERMI test, do a HERTSMI score, and the HERTSMI score is very valid. If it's greater than 15 numbers, it is going to be 99% likely that that patient will not get well in that environment. So it's very, very statistically significant. For a greater than 15 score is pretty toxic to those sick patients. Less than 11, it's probably safe. So that mid-range is kind of up to negotiation, but the numbers high and low really do have significance. So I'll often do that with my patients.
Yeah, and I think it's important. I just want to make sure people hear that it's just because they don't see black on the walls or around the vents, or you know, you can't smell it, doesn't mean it's not there. It's oftentimes hidden behind walls, or in places where you can't see it, or it's in the floors, or in places where you don't even see it. And especially in places like Utah and Colorado, where you and I live, I don't think you see as much of the visual mold mm-hmm. as maybe other places where the environment's more humid. So getting this kind of test is, I mean, I guess the thing is at first you want to see if you have this genetic issue, or if you suspect that there's mold in the house. I still think it's good, right, to find out and get that fixed. But, you know, it's important to get the genetic testing done too, to see if that's really going to affect your health, right? It's important to do all of these things. Yeah.
Yeah, because if someone doesn't have the genes, then they're very unlikely to get super sick from it. So that is to me, that's probably the number one test that I'll do, is to see, are you susceptible? And just like you said, I would say like 95% of people I suspect of mold have no idea, and it's not visible. And I would also say, just so if patients have had this experience or your listeners, very frequently someone will get an inspector, hey, everything's fine. They'll get a second inspector, everything's fine. They'll get a third or fourth inspector, and they'll find a massive issue. So if you suspect something, you may need, it's sad because it's expensive, it's difficult, but this is how this industry is, and there are good people out there, but not everybody is as good as the next person. And so you really, if you suspect something, keep going until you find it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then if someone finds that there is mold in their home, there are ways to treat that, right? There are people that can come in and fix those things. And same thing, right? You want to have something that's really good, that's not going to kind of just cover it up with some paint.
Yes. And don't throw bleach on it. For those susceptible individuals, a lot of you are like, oh, I just got some anti-mold bleach and threw it on there. What happens is as you kill the mold, the spores and the particles are released into the environment, even if it's dead. And in the genetically susceptible person, those dead mold particles are just as toxic as the live mold, maybe more so because they're dispersed throughout the house. So the worst thing someone can do is find a spot of mold, throw some bleach on it and say, we're done, because they'll continue to get ill.
Oh, wow, that's a good point. Yeah. Do you feel like there's certain types of mold that are toxic regardless of what people's genetic predisposition is? I mean, are there some cases where it doesn't matter if you don't have the gene, you still want to be careful with the mold?
Well, now that I've seen so many really sick patients with SEERs, and obviously most of them are the genetic susceptibility, but usually their family members are affected in some way. And sometimes it's just allergies or congestion or lung issues or frequent illness is common. So their immune systems are not up to par. But I would say yes, things like Stachybotrys, the typical toxic black mold, very, very dangerous. And it's been shown in animal studies and children in Africa where they have moldy food supplies and all kinds of other studies where it really, really damages human health regardless of susceptibility. And then the other thing I wanted to mention while we're on this topic, Cotomium and Stachy, those are the two big ones that are the most toxic, I would say. But the other thing I wanted to mention is one thing you started the interview with was homes and wire. And one of the things that's really contributed to this is our paints. In the 70s, they decided to add an antifungal element. So pretty much paints that we buy for our home or inside of our home, outside, have an antifungal. And what that did was it created, just like our antibiotics in the livestock, this creates fungal resistance. And so the things that have survived are 100 times more toxic than they were before. So a lot of people ask me, why is this such a big deal now? Why are we seeing so much more illness? And it's because the fungal species that we have are these hardy superbugs, and they are nasty, and they produce so many more toxins than they used to. And so it really is a bigger issue than it used to be. And we've kind of created it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for explaining that. That's something I never really thought about that, but that does make sense that to survive, the mold is going to have to be ultra resistant and ultra toxic, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've seen black mold, these certain types of mold just take over people's homes, and they have to have either the homes taken down or extensive remodeling to get rid of that because it's so toxic. So yeah. It's important for people to realize that it can be toxic to everybody. So if someone knows that they have the genetic predisposition and they have symptoms, what is the treatment?
Yeah, so a doctor who understands SEERs will do a panel of lab tests. They may have them test the house, so they'll get enough data. They'll just be collecting all that data, and when they find enough data that they're like, yeah, this person has CIRS, the very first thing is what we already talked about, and that's remediate or get the home fixed. And again, I've had patients who have both work and home exposures. And one thing that I don't take lightly is the financial impact of this disease, because say your home is full of mold. I mean, you may have to sell it. May have to move. You may not be able to sell it. And patients deal with these difficult issues all the time. It's never easy. Years ago, part of why I am so familiar with this was my office building had a mold issue. I had to move, and I literally left everything, Trevor. I left everything and started over. And of course, that had a financial impact. For me, it was worth it, because health is everything, and you can't buy health. And so every penny I lost was worth it for my health. But I had to deal with that. And so how much more do my patients, whether it be deciding to leave a workplace? Because often if it's a government employer or a school, it's these schools, these government employers are not always able to fix the problem. So sometimes it means losing a job. Sometimes it means losing a home. Sometimes it means all of these things. But back to treatment. Number one, you cannot hardly get well if you don't get out of the exposure. And that's why I'm spending so much time on this, because in some people, just by getting out of exposure will start to heal. So that is just such a core thing. The second thing, and I would say the second most profound, is binders. So Dr. Shoemaker has studied prescription binders, cholestyramine and Welchol. And cholestyramine is quite a bit more effective, but it's really a pain to take. It's a powder you mix with juice or some sort of liquid, and it tastes terrible. It needs to be taken about 4 times a day, 2 hours away from food or supplements. So it's really a pain to take, but it's very, very effective. And what that does is our liver will take these toxins and throw them out into the bile acids. And the bile acids are how we eliminate through the gut toxic exposures, not just mold, mycotoxins, but other toxins as well. So these particles are charged. charged cholestyramine and Wilpcol, and they'll go in and they'll grab onto the toxins from the bile, their bile acid binders, and they'll pull them out through the gut. And so these patients, little by little by little, this is aiding their detox. I always add things like sauna, dry brushing, Epsom salt baths, hydrotherapy, any sort of other therapy where they're doing sweating, even just regular exercise, can be beneficial, because this is a toxic exposure and detoxification is really the core. The Wellcol is much more convenient. It's tablets that can be taken once or twice a day. It's very expensive and it is not as effective as cholestyramine, but those patients who have gut issues like bloating or constipation, they won't tolerate cholestyramine. So then we use Wellcol. Now in my practice, there's not yet studies to back this up, but I have found in clinical practice that clay and charcoal and other binders that are not prescription are very effective too. And I often combine multiple binders for that patient to get well.
Okay, that's great. And so do you have your own product that you make, or do you have them?
I love the Dave's Bulletproof Charcoal, the upgraded coconut charcoal. That's very, very effective. And then other patients have used zeolite. I don't use that frequently, but I've heard from other practitioners that it can be effective. And then things like chlorella and spirulina, which are just good for heavy metals and other things, can be helpful as well.
Perfect. And so what I would love to do is get links to these things from you so that, sure, I can share them on my website, so people don't have to be trying to figure out how to spell everything, because, yes, I'm sure there's some technical spelling on some, like the websites and the tests and those sorts of, and the treatments and things. So, and so does that help support the immune system? Are there other things that you do to help support the immune system with treatment?
Yeah, so those are just the first two steps of treating SIRS, and those are really the most important. But after that, another thing that's real important is we mentioned MSH, melanocyte stimulating hormone. Frequently in SIRS patients, this is absent or totally very, very low. And that is part of the direction of the pituitary for our endocrine system, so our female-male hormones. It's part of our thyroid, adrenal axis, and pituitary. And so what happens when that MSH is low is all kinds of systems are affected. And in order to raise the MSH, we have to do a swab in the nose on the patients and see if they're colonized with a bacteria called Marcans. And this is a multi-drug resistant organism that creates biofilms, and these biofilms destroy MSH. So it's kind of a long roundabout story, but the key is that MSH will never recover, and therefore thyroid, adrenal, hormones, until you fix MSH and you get rid of the bug in the nose. So that's the third step, is checking the patients for Marcans and treating that if they're positive. It's a prescription antibiotic nasal spray for 4 weeks, and that usually takes care of the issue. And then you look at other labs and fix those as you go. And lots of other supportive things, just like we mentioned, sauna and gentle exercise and supporting the gut, supporting the liver, are really helpful in these patients as well. But I did write an article including all of this just for information for patients. So if you go to my blog, my website is just jillcarnahan.com, and just Google mold, there's an article that kind of puts together, what do you test for? What do you, you know, do? How can I find out if this is me? And a lot of those links and tips are there. And then for other patients, we mentioned testing. Mycometrics.com is a good place to start. You can find a good inspector. And if you go to survivingmold.com, there's a wealth of information about lab testing and resources for remediators and inspectors there. And there's lots of free content. And then there's some other things you can purchase from. I have no affiliation with the site, but they have good resources there as well. And again, that's Dr. Shoemaker's website. So there's lots of information. Thank you for having me, Trevor, and thanks for all you do. I love your podcast. All you listeners listen to every episode. They're great.
I hope you enjoyed this interview today with Dr. Jill Carnahan. To learn more about Dr. Jill, you can visit my website, thespadoctor.com. Go to the podcast page with her interview, and y'all see all the information and links there, all the information that she talked about and the valuable resources and tests that she talked about today. You'll see the links there. So while you're there, I also invite you to join the Spa Doctor community on my website or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you don't miss any of our upcoming shows. And if you haven't done so already, I highly recommend you get your own customized skin report at theskinquiz.com. It's free and based upon the answers to just a few questions, you'll get your own customized skin report. Just go to theskinquiz.com. Also, don't miss out on the latest tips to get glowing, healthy skin from the inside and out. Be sure to follow me on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, and Twitter, and join the conversation. Thank you, and I'll see you next time on the Spa Doctor Podcast.